Good morning. Thank you for joining us. I'm Katy Huberty, Morgan Stanley's IT hardware analyst, and I am absolutely pleased to welcome Arvind Krishna, Senior Vice President of Cloud and Cognitive Software. Arvind is also responsible for IBM Research, so driving technologies like quantum computing, as well as the impending acquisition of Red Hat. So he's a very busy man. We're lucky to have him today. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure to be here, Katy.
Before we begin, I just need to read quickly that please note that all important disclosures, including personal holdings disclosures and Morgan Stanley disclosures, appear on the Morgan Stanley public website or at the registration desk. So with that behind us, let me start with a question about your new role and your new title and how your responsibilities are changing and what that means for IBM.
Look, the new role is really constructed around a couple of observations. One, data and cloud platforms are really critical to how our clients are going to go into the future and how we are going to take them into the future. So the first and most critical part is putting it together, and that then includes AI, it includes hybrid cloud, and it includes the impending acquisition of Red Hat in that piece. The next is that in addition to that, I also have an area called cognitive applications. So this is our areas around areas like IoT, asset management, supply chain, customer engagement applications. And those are actually built on our cloud and data platforms, and that makes sense as we infuse them with AI to put them there. And that also then includes our weather platform, which has got a lot of our AI assets coming in there. And then research, as you mentioned, which is exciting because the goal then is to use these business units to take the research assets and transform them into the business to create value for the company and for our clients.
That's a great segue into my next question because IBM is really known for leading in patent generation and R&D around core enterprise applications. Over your time at IBM, you've been a pioneer in new businesses like security and upcoming in quantum. So help bring us behind the curtain of IBM. How does the company go about deciding which big bets to make? And what does the process look like taking an idea from conception to monetization?
Sure. And I'll use a couple of examples maybe to make that sort of come to life. Look, the first thing is you got to have the correct talent. And we are very fortunate to be able to have a collection of about 3,000 researchers around the globe. We have them in 12 locations. And the point of that is not so much to spread it. The point of that is to be able to get insights from the different markets and the physical locations that people are in. And I'll use a blockchain example in a minute to make that come to life. Two, we are very fortunate that these people are really productive. I mean, last year we produced about 9,000 patents out of these folks working with others, but the majority came from them. And out of those 9,000, over half were in areas that you'll all recognize as critical to the future of the planet. 2,000 odd in cloud, 1,600 in AI, 1,400 on cybersecurity. So that's just sort of an evidence point of the inventiveness and the sheer relevance of the work they are doing. Then if you begin to look, of course, you make some bets. In a research organization, some things are longer term, some things are shorter term. I think that the value of our management is that you take some things and you recognize when are they about to turn into things that have real commercial implications and that our clients can begin to exploit for real business advantage. About 3 years ago, blockchain was an example like that. You saw that there was a big need for blockchain that was way beyond cryptocurrency of how it could play into supply chain and into the real world. And the moment you make that recognition, now, using my other role, there becomes a chance to harness those technologists together with the business unit to say, go turn this now into something which can begin to scale and can have an impact. And quantum, which Katy mentioned, is one that I'm really excited about because I think we are right on the horizon of quantum turning into one of those. And then you get the fortunate part of coupling the technologists who are pushing and making the technology real into now, all right, how do I begin to scale this over the next few years? And that's sort of the art or science of this, Katy.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that. Let's talk a little bit about AI. Most companies that we speak to have AI machine learning projects in the lab. They're doing proof of concepts. But the feedback, and this was an important message out of the IBM Think conference a couple of weeks ago here in San Francisco, is that companies are realizing there's still a lot of blocking and tackling work to do around their information or their data architecture, yeah. You know, collecting all the data that they create in the business, cleansing it, governance, et cetera. And so I guess the question would be, are we taking a step back, and is AI actually harder to accomplish than everybody thought a couple of years ago? And will it ramp on a slower pace than maybe we thought?
I think it is harder than we probably thought a couple of years ago, but I don't think it'll be slower. So first, you got to look at the opportunity to transform a business. If you look at AI, I think every survey will indicate that 85% or maybe 100% of all companies and business organizations agree that AI will play a major role in their future. And it's in various parts. Does it help make people more productive by taking away mundane and menial tasks? Does it help in better decision-making? Does it enable new revenue models by allowing things at a cost point that just wasn't possible before? The second part is, if you take a big macro view, there's been lots of studies that talk about adding trillions of dollars to the world's GDP. The estimate that, to me, is mind-blowing is they talk about $16 trillion by 2030, and within that, a good $3.6 trillion is not even by new revenue. It's in terms of productivity. Right. So you got this massive opportunity on one side. Then you face the startling fact that Katie said, is it harder? Only 4% penetration has happened so far. So that's pretty low compared to what I just pointed out is the massive, massive positive opportunity. And I think that a big inhibitor has been that as you kind of take it from experimentation, which, as you point out, there's been lots of, you begin to realize that to take it into full production, if you're in a regulated industry, you need to be able to show why you made that decision. So you need explainability. Then you get into, is it fair, meaning you're not having some bias on any of the attributes that none of us as humans want bias on, be it color of skin, be it gender, be it ethnicity, be it zip code, be it any of those things. You need to get into, can you show where the data is that you used to train it and not that you just picked it out of the ether and began to use it? And as you look at this collection of things that I'll call governance, you begin to get into how do you help enterprises not just create the AI, but really run it at scale, manage it at scale, govern it at scale, along with now the balances, you can't now lock it down completely, along with using all of the innovation that's happening both in the open source and in the rest of the world. So you got to have that balance point between those two. And our viewpoint is that we've got to help our clients do that. And so sort of I think a big learning that as we are getting into this phase of AI is, can we create the tool sets that let our clients sort of have the flexibility to experiment but be able to turn it into production against some of the inhibitors I talked about. And some of you may have heard, we talked about a set of capabilities that I'm using the moniker Watson Anywhere, meaning that you can run it where you want, being on your premise, in a private cloud or a public cloud, but that helps you against these inhibitors I talked about on how do you build a model, not just, by the way, using IBM pieces, but if you want to, any of the open source pieces, including TensorFlow and so on, and how do you actually then govern it against the life cycle? Can you prove that you tested it for fairness? Can you prove that nobody corrupted it? Can you show a regulator, here is the training data set, or is the performance of in production close enough to what I got during training, or has it drifted off because real data is very different than training data? So I think these are the inhibitors. We got some answers, and that's why I believe that this chapter is really going to be how you scale AI into business processes.
IBM's in a unique position because you engaged very early on with Watson proof of concepts. And so what have you learned from companies that have rolled out AI and have been successful scaling it? What did they have to go through to reach those objectives?
A couple of observations. A big one from the business side and then a couple on the technology. So on business, I think to really take advantage of AI, it's not, I call it a cherry on top. It's not I'm doing something and now let me throw in a little AI to go get a, you know, a sentence completion or something, complete a sentence in a chatbot. Those are useful, but those are not enough. You have to begin to think through how do I really improve my business process when I do this? So if I'm doing underwriting, can I really help AI to say, well, I know a lot of things already. I don't need to ask 6,000 questions. Maybe I can shorten what I'm asking because I know this and I can use the AI to actually guide what are the smaller number of things. Those begin to really help in how you engage customer intimacy and how you begin to really improve the process for a customer. At our Think Conference, we actually had Geico talk a little bit about this, but it's not unique to Geico. People who make, I think, big changes, whether it's a Geico or Credit Mutual or a Bradesco, just to take three examples, which are global, one in France, one in Brazil, one in the U.S., that's one part, and I call that a business sense. I mean, it really is the business owner realizing it's not just a technology. I need to think about, can I make my business take advantage of this? And then the second big learning is, look, it's unfortunate, but 80% of the work still lies in the data collection. We all love where AI has come. It's come on the back of a technology called deep learning. Deep learning takes lots and lots of labeled data sets, which means that the whole problem of collecting data and organizing data is a massive task. And you get into this argument all the time, right? I mean, yesterday I think I was talking to somebody in a manufacturing industry, and they said, oh, our data scientists said they can solve this problem instantly. And they went to the engineer, and the engineer said, oh, I have all this data, but you clean it and you organize it and you cleanse it. And the two look at each other and they say, who's going to do that 6 months of work? And so you got to come up with much better answers on how do you collect and organize the data to way lower the barrier on how you can take away that months and months of task, labor, cost, and impatience. And we think we have some techniques on how to do it. I begin to use words like, hey, can we use AI itself to automate these tasks? Not for the end goal, but can you apply AI to this? Some people will call it recursive AI or auto AI, et cetera. Can you use it to cleanse your data, to organize your data, to select algorithms and so on, but dramatically reduce the amount of time it takes for these pieces? And so you might have heard us use the word, there is no AI without information architecture, and so no AI without IA. And so you got to have an information architecture, and bringing those pieces together is why we sort of focus very heavily on that as a big aid and an accelerant to getting AI adopted. And so, so you hear us talk a lot about that, and you see some of that, by the way, in results. I mean, that's why analytics and the data businesses are showing a big resurgence for, I think, us and the industry, because this is a big topic.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. But investor perspective is, you know, here's a large technology company. We've had some big trends like mobile and at least chapter one of cloud that maybe IBM didn't fully capture the opportunity. Why will IBM win in AI and actually lead in AI when it hasn't in some of the recent trends?
Yeah. So I think, Katie, it goes back to some of the words, and I'll sort of maybe explain the chapter one, chapter two analogy to the crowd. So chapter one is was really, I think, very heavily driven by what's happening in consumer much more than by enterprise. So in the first chapter of AI, you know, can I recognize faces? Can I recognize animals? Can I recognize who's wearing my sneakers if I'm an apparel company and begin to do that? Which means that it's at scale, it's a big consumer thing. It didn't matter if it's being done completely in the public domain. You go leverage that, and those platforms begin to see it, right? I mean, all of us use voice assistants. 5 years ago, that was a dream. Today, it's kind of real, which means people with big data sets, but you're not really using any of those to do a lot of mission-critical applications, but they're certainly big productivity aids. Now you come around to, but I want to use AI in underwriting, to stick to my example. Now, how do I begin to do that? I'm going to likely have big training sets, actually not so big. I might have a few million examples, not a few billion examples. If I get down to trying to understand, hey, underwriting for roofs that have had hail damage in the Southwest, now you're down to a few thousand examples. So how do you begin to create the AI that you're pretty sure meets the guardrails, couples together with rules, couples together with regulations? It's not just, I'll call it just sort of AI, and I can accept a 4% error rate, because if that's your error rate on a on a home speech device, that's okay. I mean, like, that's way better than not having it. So in that world, how do you begin to put that together? I believe that that's where our ability to take the AI, not just in a big public cloud, but to take it to people's presence and to take it onto their premise or to take it onto their private cloud, really focus on how do you learn from smaller data sets and fit all these regulations and guardrails and ethics and fairness tests and be able to prove which data set was used to train it. I think it's this combination coupled with all of the business rules that I think is really going to advantage us in these applications. By the way, note, I think the consumer guys have done great, and I think they'll keep going. I think that is a whole area unto itself. But there's an enterprise side of meeting all these constraints that is a little bit different, where I think is where we will be advantaged.
So when we think about companies having to address the information architecture before they can really scale AI, is that a big revenue opportunity? And might that even be bigger than some of the revenue driven by early Watson engagements?
I think it's a big revenue opportunity, and I'll address your part on the compare part. So if you look at it today, the rough estimate is there's 180 zettabytes of data that's going to be out there very soon, by the middle of this coming decade. And if you think about 180 zettabytes, not even 0.1% of that is there on any one particular infrastructure. And you can think about which is your biggest personal favorite. Okay, so if that's the case, and then you come to the enterprise side, the estimate is 80%, and when I say 80%, most enterprise CIOs look at me and say, no, it's probably 90% of the data is dark and untouched and not leveraged. So that's the opportunity. Now, why is it unleveraged? It's lying in silos. It lies across 3,000 distinct applications. How do you bring it all together? How do you, what I use the word collect, which is the first part of an information architecture. Once you collect it, how do you extract some metadata from it, which is how do you organize it or cleanse it? In order to do this, you need tools. The old-style tools of doing this in the warehouse world also used to have the same answers. Oh, my God, 80% of the problem is not the warehouse analytics. It's collecting the data and organizing it. So if you now say, look, but a lot of techniques have come along over the last decade, a lot of big data techniques, a lot of unstructured data techniques, a lot of applying AI to create data and metadata automatically, a lot of federation techniques that you don't need to always move the data into a big data lake. You can actually federate and use the data where it is. So how do you bring all this together to really create an information architecture that is the enabler of AI? And I think when I look at where we are seeing a lot of traction and where we are seeing a lot of success is in enabling people to do AI by building these out. So to answer your question, in the near term, yes, I actually believe that the opportunity on doing all this so then people can do their AI on this with the collection of different teams and data scientists is probably significantly larger than the narrow AI opportunity itself. But they're symbiotic. As you do one and make it easier, you'll do more on AI. As you do more on AI, you need to do more on IA. And so sort of they feed each other. And I want to note something. You can't make this into a completely vertical stack that only our AI works on our IA. You've got to enable it. Hey, if you collect the information, this is a gulp for many. It's got to let you use the AI tools of your choice, not just our AI tools. And by the way, when you federate the data may lie in repositories that are not IBM's. They may lie in others. But do I still want to help apply AI tools to bring the metadata and to bring it all together? So that's opening up a big ecosystem and the opportunity on both of those.
This is an important point because the cognitive division has been viewed by investors as the measure of Watson's success, fairly or unfairly, right? And the revenue growth from that division has been choppy over the last couple of years. Do you think that the sale of some of the slower growth horizontal apps or declining horizontal apps combined with this acceleration that you're seeing in spend around data architecture will actually create a dynamic where that division can grow on a more sustained basis?
I certainly believe so, and that's the reason we did it. So if I look at the first part of what Katie mentioned, In December, we announced that we are divesting a certain part of our assets that we believe, well, we didn't believe. We know that they are slower growing. They're declining, actually, around collaboration and some on-premise apps around marketing and commerce. And that collection was negative in revenue growth and was a contributor to the choppiness because the other pieces couldn't always make up for the decline that is seen in these pieces. So one side is take the pieces that are slower growing. I'll call that that's portfolio optimization, as all of you would expect us to do. But they also didn't have a lot of synergy with the other pieces, meaning we didn't observe that they were often sold together or there was a large technology, bidirectional, symbiotic nature between those pieces and the others. And so it's always hard to divest, but it wasn't that they were sort of intertwined with everything else. Mm-hmm. So that's one part of what we did. And then the other part is, as part of Chapter 2, now there is suddenly much more of a need to not just do the information architecture, but to actually do it sometimes in a private sense, sometimes in a public sense. And as the enterprise nature and the mission-critical nature of AI grows, and as people want to do it on private clouds and on their own premise as well, those two come together to create sort of the positive vector mm-hmm. and to get rid of a negative vector that sort of put together then is a big help to get rid of the choppiness and to put a more sustained performance out there.
Let's talk a little bit about cloud. IBM talks about entering Chapter 2 of cloud, sort of like we talked about AI Chapter 1, Chapter 2. How is Chapter 2 different than Chapter 1?
Yeah. So when we look at enterprises, and I believe I mentioned this a few minutes ago, enterprises have thousands of applications. And when you look at it, you say, how much has already moved into public cloud? And the estimate right now for larger enterprises is between 19 and 21%. Whether you go to the Gartners, you go to the big consulting firms like the McKinsey's, the BCG's, it sits around there. And so you say, okay, but cloud has all these opportunities. Cloud could help in scaling. Cloud can help in cost. Cloud can certainly help in renting compute. Why are we only 19 to 21% there? So what we're calling Chapter 2 is now how do you move mission-critical applications? Because in some sense, those that were very client-facing, those that are sort of decoupled or pure software as a service are the ones that have moved. And now this next set has a mission-critical nature, and the mission-critical nature has different properties. You kind of worry about latency. You start worrying about what else is it intertwined with? How do I quickly assess what should stay where it is, what could move to private, what can move to public? That is something where I think that we have a much larger set of capabilities to bring, a much larger set of value to bring to our clients by providing the tools or the expertise to help people assess, to come up with these roadmaps, as well as since on the mission critical side, there's a lot of incumbency both on the applications and the management that we have. How can we help people on this transition? And it's when you talk about this, that we firmly believe that people are going to live in a hybrid world. And I don't want to make hybrid into something magical. Hybrid is I got something that's my traditional data center. I got something that's going into a private cloud. I got something that's going into a public cloud. How do I manage and how do I operate across this mixture of these three worlds? And that's what I want to label as hybrid, not some new thing unto itself. Mm-hmm. And then when you talk to these customers, they already have 4 or 5 clouds. Some of them talk about having 10 or 16. And so I think multi-cloud is a reality. So how do you play into multi-cloud when you accept that they're all going to use multiple clouds? And so the old world of integration comes back in a big way of how do you help people in this world, A, make the transition to hybrid, and then two, help them on their journey to multiple clouds, not just one cloud. And I'll put that together and call that Chapter 2, and one which I believe is much better aligned to both our capabilities and our incumbency.
Mm-hmm. So as you said, 20% of enterprise workloads running in the public cloud today. What do you hear from your customers in terms of the benefits that drive them to the public cloud, and where do you think that 20% lands longer term?
So I'm going to expand the definition of cloud first. So if I'll say cloud includes both private cloud and public cloud. Mm-hmm. And if you expand that definition of private and public, then we believe that two-thirds is going to move there. Now, is that going to be over 2 or 3 years or over 5 years? I think we'd all agree. I mean, like, it kind of doesn't matter. It's going to get there. But now you say, okay, if that's a mixture of private and public, so way up from the 20%, now where is it going to end up? Is it private or is it public? The work we have done shows that across the industry and globe as an aggregate, it's about 40-60, meaning 40% onto private and 60% onto public. So if you do that math, 60% or two-thirds, so in the mid-30%, so the 20 goes up to the high 30s over time. But there's a good 25% that's also sitting on private cloud. So that's a big, big motion. Then the inhibitors come. Wow, do I really want to live in like six distinct silos because every public cloud vendor builds their own stack, much like everybody did back in the traditional data center days? Or can I get into some commonality? How do I make these moves? What are some common fabrics and some common techniques I can begin to use to make these moves across from my traditional to private to public? How do I assess which application should reside where? And so this mixture of problems and portability is sort of the opportunity and the inhibitor. And I'll put it out there. I firmly believe that sort of Linux and containers is going to be a big, big part of the answer, the same way as kind of TCP/IP and the web browser kind of became the basis for the internet. That was mid-1990s. We can go to Java and web services. That was sort of a big, big driver. There has to be an anchor thing that we all agree on that kind of becomes the pinch point, so we remove the inhibitor and then go forward from there.
That's a great segue to start talking about the announced Red Hat acquisition. At IBM Think, Ginny mentioned to a small group of us that you were actually the person at the company that drove this viewpoint around having more of an open approach to cloud, which you've brought up several times. Talk about what the driving force was behind that view, and how does the acquisition of Red Hat enhance IBM's cloud strategy in that respect?
Thanks, Katie. And so a lot of it is going to reflect on certain comments I've been making. So clients want to use multiple public clouds. Each cloud is going to be the best, certainly at something, right? That's not a surprise. Then if clients are going to use multiple clouds, if you try to force them onto using only one, that's a closed approach or a proprietary approach. So if you go open, then you have a chance to help them on their journey to all of these clouds. Two, then you got to say, what's the basis of being open? So you begin by looking at the base and you say, what do most workloads run on? Right at the most lowest level. Linux is now the majority of the operating systems that are in the world. Crossed over well over 50%, I think in either late 17 or early 18. That's one observation. Two, then you say, okay, that's great, but now, I mean, like, if I got to move it, it's still painful if I got to move it server by server and workload by workload. So you say, can I get a next layer up? And that's when I believe that looking at the open world of containers and Kubernetes, that offers a great set of tools to say, look, I can take a collection of workloads, and if I put them on one, then I can move them both from traditional into private and from private into public of choice. And so if you begin to say, who can help in that movement? Who has a great collection of technologies and who has a great play on open and always has, you sort of very quickly gravitate to, okay, Red Hat has those. And then you say, okay, if they have all those, then how does IBM come into the picture to sort of help on that? Well, but clients need a lot of expertise on going down that path. We need to accelerate the movement of all of the software, both other open source, well beyond Red Hat, as well as proprietary open source, onto these container fabrics. I mean, a container fabric is not just like taking something, freeze-drying it, and running it there. You got to worry about taking away the operational complexity. So that's a lot of work to be done, both for custom applications as well as for standard applications. And then that's why we believe the combination of the two of us really frees this up and opens the aperture to offer a lot of value back to clients and to sort of take sort of what I'm expressing as an open but Linux and container-driven approach, and to scale it in a much more massive way than either of us could have done on our own.
And what's the customer feedback been so far?
Well, I probably got 100 either in person or client calls since October 29th. Mm-hmm. A lot of people sort of called this thing. And I think that the reaction, once you explain a couple of things to them, has been universally positive. And to be clear, the couple of things that come up is, hey, wait a moment, are you going to make Red Hat somehow unique to IBM? And the answer is absolutely not. Red Hat's value lies in being in having the broadest base. They support 5,000 different server types, so that means hundreds of different hardware vendors. They support all the public clouds. They support anybody's software who wants to write on top. So that's what I call being open, and we are absolutely committed to maintaining that. Not going to touch that. Red Hat folks, employees, have the expertise on how to maintain that and do that, and we've got to maintain that. Two, they're wonderful participants in the upstream ecosystem of open source. They participate in that. They contribute massively back to it. They leverage it. It's a matter of there's no control in open source. It's a matter of participation, and it's meritocratic. So you got to maintain that piece of it, and that's a thing that people ask. They're not so concerned about. And the other question people always ask is, hey, are you going to do something funky around pricing? And I look at them and I say, hey, these are volume-based plays. I mean, like, there's so much choice. I mean, Red Hat has the expertise, and they have worked out what works for themselves and their clients, and we have no intention of mucking around with that or their contracts or anything. And usually when you get through those conversations, people love the value so much that once you kind of get rid of, I'll call it, these edge issues, they all feel really comfortable then that this is a great place for it, and they'll get even more value from Red Hat mm-hmm. as we go forward.
What are the advantages IBM gets from owning Red Hat versus partnering? And since you're in charge of integrating this thing, what are the biggest revenue synergy opportunities?
Yeah. So if it was only Red Hat Linux, I'd have to look at you honestly and say probably partnering is equal to owning.
Yeah.
Because in Red Hat Linux, it has to support everything. There is absolutely no particular plus or minus. It is server by server. You know, any services team can use it. Any product team can use it. So if I take that and put it on the side, then I'll say that one is not the cause of all the synergies. But if I now go back to what I explained on hybrid cloud and what played out in Chapter 2 of AI as well, we are at the early infancy of that. How do we make sure that these fabrics, which I'm saying on Linux and containers, they do become the fabric on which a hybrid cloud is established as the architectural footprint for most clients, but based on an open source and open governance methodology? That is something we can do together, which would have been impossible to do kind of just as loose partners, where both partner with a bunch of others. Then it's so hard to say, okay, I'll bet all in on only one, because partners can make different decisions mm-hmm. a year or two down the
right.
road. If I take the entire IBM software stack, well, okay, do I run it only on Red Hat, or do I run it on 15 other variants of containers and so on? So it's less from a Red Hat than from an IBM side that we can begin to say, okay, now we can begin to make decisions down one. So that's a product synergy side. Then a whole second side is our services teams spend a lot of time out in the field working with the clients, helping them on these hybrid cloud journeys, assessing the workloads, moving the workloads, making recommendations on architectures, et cetera. And we are going to grow large services practices with depth of expertise and experience on the Red Hat technologies, explicitly on OpenShift and Ansible and CloudForms and all of these. As that becomes a base on which they have expertise, that's a very large opportunity for our services teams as they bring that expertise in turn to clients all over the globe in helping them embark on their hybrid cloud journeys. And note, I didn't say it's confined to IBM clouds. This will be helping them with hybrid cloud onto many clouds, including IBM, but also the big ones that they are all using already, including AWS and Azure.
So the intention here is to have Red Hat, you know, run on its own versus the rest of the IBM business after acquisition. What processes or incentives do you have in place to, you know, maintain the employee culture, to maintain the developer community of Red Hat?
I'll begin with the one that I think is a little bit This is a little bit facetious. This is a little bit funny. So when I talk to some of the senior management, because we can't quite engage with all of the people until we get through regulatory closure,
right.
I asked them, I said, you know, what is going to be some of the things that are going to be the biggest? And they looked at me and they said, are you going to change the potato chips? And I thought, like, they meant chips? I mean, like, did they say, no, we really like Cape Cod chips. You can't change that to some other IBM standard. I said, peace. We're not going to change your potato chip standards. You know, you buy what you like, because developers do like their food and their caffeinated drinks, believe me. So you got to go do that, right? So that is sort of minor things. Be careful that you don't let, I think it's a good proxy for, don't let a larger company's processes or bureaucracy kind of at the edges go touch how they behave. Mm-hmm. But on a more serious note, I mean, to me, they know how to really participate in the open source ecosystem. What does that give them? That gives them a great look into who might be amenable to wanting to come work at Red Hat as opposed to somewhere else. They get a great look into which college students are heavily participating in that. You've got to maintain that openness. That means that their developers, probably a good 1,000 of them, work very heavily in different open source ecosystems. They have a set of people who are very involved in the governance of these open source ecosystems. So those are all things to me that their teams really know how to do well. They really know how to participate. They really know how to both give and derive value, because I'm very clear, you can never just take value. You have to give back value to these communities, and they know how to do that. We have zero intention of touching that. They will maintain their processes, their comp practices, their hiring practices around how they go do all that and how those people participate, no different rules for them around whether it's intellectual property or whether it's participation or whether it's give back and how code is shared and not shared, etc. You have to get into then, if I look at the sales teams, I know you asked about developer, mm-hmm. but the sales teams, I mean, why would every hardware vendor be comfortable sharing plans and working with them? You got to make sure that it is to the sales team's advantage, and people see sales teams through incentives. I mean, the first thing they'll always ask is, what are you paid on? So it's got to be neutral. The way they're paid on today, which is to be neutral across all platforms and to be really motivated to make any platform succeed, is how they got to remain paid. So on the sales team side, it's got to be neutral. They cannot be biased towards anything that is IBM. And so both those sides, because I think they work really in sync to sort of reinforce each other, are sort of some examples of what we will do and are committed to do to go maintain the value of Red Hat.
Exciting. So we only have 2 minutes left. And you mentioned in the beginning that you're really excited about quantum computing. And I know 2 minutes isn't nearly enough time. But just you know, in the time we have left, decode quantum computing a bit for us and help us understand what it will allow some industries to do that they can't do today. What will be some of the early use cases?
So I'm going to stay away from the technology of quantum, because that would be the hours that Katie alluded to.
Right.
So first, quantum computing is no longer in this realm of science fiction. Quantum computing is real. I mean, a very simple example we have, I'll call them small, but they're not tiny. Small quantum computers working as a system today, not just as a bunch of qubits on a chip. By system, I mean a real computer that you can insert into it, I have a problem, and it comes back with an answer, mm-hmm. and you can do this millions of times over, not just once. So we are there. The kind of problems quantum is doing are not replacements for standard computers. I want to say that. People who think quantum is going to run a bank account, never going to happen. What quantum is good at doing at is some problems that are almost impossible for normal computers to do. I believe that the first phase of problems are going to be around materials and financial risk. By materials, how do you govern the properties of alloys? How can I come up with another molecule that may be good for a water filter? Today, these are all what I call wet lab experiments. Somebody good probably has intuition. They think of something, they construct it using a few weeks or months, then they test it using a few weeks or months, and then they find it doesn't work and repeat. Now you can do that in a few seconds or a few minutes on a quantum computer, because it's really good at figuring out the properties of physical materials. Mm-hmm. As it gets bigger, that will extend into pharmaceuticals. A couple of examples of early companies who are working with us on materials. One example is Daimler, who's really interested in working in battery technology, because the molecules and battery technologies, this is the throwaway for those not interested in the chemistry, are all around lithium hydride. Those are small enough materials that actually quantum computers are going to beginning to address in a few years. So imagine if you could create a better battery or better materials for auto batteries. That's an industry worth tens of billions, and the auto industry worth trillions then as an impact right there. Or the basic materials industries, if you look at people like JSR in Japan, they work on specialty chemicals, and these are not as complex as pharmaceuticals, but specialty chemicals used in manufacturing, lubricants in the petrochemical industry, these are all going to be within reach in the next few years. And, of course, financial risk, which is a huge topic in terms of how various things are priced in the financial industry, is another area where I think these are going to come to bear 3 years, 5 years, somewhere in that realm in a very real sense.
That's great. Thank you so much. You'll have to come back and talk to us more about quantum computing in the next couple of years as it really takes off. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Katie.